May it please the court and counsel. My name is Douglas Lee Harville. I'm here today on behalf of Corey L. Morris. Mr. Morris is here today because he has alleged two errors before the district court. In principle, the government concedes both errors. The first error is that Mr. Morris's sentence was improperly enhanced under section 2B1.1B10B sub I, in that the government concedes this error in principle, in that two points were incorrectly added to Mr. Morris's sentence. As I will address later, the government, however, notes that even if you have this error, it did not affect Mr. Morris's substantial rights, and therefore remand is not necessary. In the alternative, the U.S. asked the court to engage in a novel concept, and that is to review the propriety of the enhancement under an alternative section. As I'll address later, neither of these arguments suffice, and this court should vacate the sentence and remand this matter for resentencing. Mr. Morris's second point is that the written judgment was erroneous in the way that it sentenced him, a point which the government concedes and states that this court should remand the matter for resentencing. It was purely, I believe, a typographical error on the court's part. Therefore, I will not address that before this court at this time, unless your honors have questions on that second issue.
Whereas I understand, consistent with what you just said, the only issue before us really is there a way to fix the enhancement that was used shifting from one to the other, and that's really the only thing before us. Would you agree?
I would agree, although I'm a little concerned with one of the government's arguments in that it said that even if there was error, that the district court and enhance it, Mr. Morris's guideline range was between 86, I believe, and 105 months, and he was sentenced at 96. And the government makes the argument that implicitly, therefore, the district court said 96 months is a correct sentence whether or not this guideline applies. If the court does not believe that, then I'm willing to not make that argument. But my argument is, under a case that I've just submitted to the court, United States versus Carrizales-Jaramillo, that because Mr. Morris has properly calculated guideline range, would have been the maximum of that range would have been less than what he was sentenced to, there was a clear error, a plain error rather, that affected his substantial rights and would infect the integrity of the judicial process if that sentence were imposed. So therefore, I don't.
And Mr. Harrell, what are you saying this case that you just handed us says? What does that add to your argument?
What it adds to my argument, Your Honor, is this. It states that if you have a sentence that is imposed and that sentence is imposed as the result of an incorrect calculation of a guideline range or guideline application, that you automatically have plain error, because that shows that the sentence, that the defendant can meet his burden of proving a probability that but for the sentencing error, he would have received a lesser sentence. And that's exactly what happened in this case. If you take away those two points, you have a guideline range that the maximum of that guideline range is less than the district court's imposed sentence.
Well, you have referred in your brief a few times to plain error and then just did. There was an objection filed to the use of this two-level enhancement. It did focus on what you are now saying, and the government somewhat concedes, was the impropriety of it. It doesn't seem to me that this is a plain error case.
Well, and, Your Honor, I initially argued under clear error out of an abundance of caution, though, and I believe that in this case, under any standard, and I adopted the more stringent standard of plain error, I believe that we can meet that burden. I do agree with Your Honor, this was something that was presented to the court, although in a different color, a different tact, but it was addressed to the court. However, I believe that even if you impose the tougher plain error standard, in this case, we meet that because we do show that the defendant's substantial rights were violated. So it was just more out of an abundance of caution that I addressed the harder standard. Now, because we can meet the plain error standard under the first enhancement, I would argue that under 18 U.S.C. Section 3742F1, that this court should remand this matter for resentencing. There was an error in the application of the sentencing guideline, and under 3742F1, that requires a reversal so the district court can impose the correct sentence. Even though, if you accept the government's argument in the plain error argument, as I've just stated, we overcome that. We show that his rights were violated. There was plain error. Now, if you go to the more interesting, I think the harder argument, and that's the can this court correct the district court's error by going to a different sentencing guideline? I don't think that this court needs to answer that question, and it's a novel question, as the government admits, never been addressed by this court before. But the section that they would seek the enhancement under, which is section 2B1.1Ci, requires that the defendant use a means of identification to create another means of identification. In section 2B1 in the notes, it defines means of identification to be identification by another individual other than the defendant. What Your Honors have before you is an allegation and an admission in a nolo contendere plea that the defendant used his mother's Social Security number to create a driver's license for himself. In that very admission that he created a driver's license for himself, that's not a means of identification for another individual. So there is no proper way, even if this court were to entertain it, to enhance under an alternative provision. Because of this, Your Honors, I believe that I would respectfully submit, and Mr. Morris would respectfully submit, that this court has but one alternative. Because he has shown an error by the district court, and that alternative is to vacate a sentence and remand it, and you can do that under one of three ways. You can find it under section 3742F1, which the government concedes there was a mistake in the application of the sentencing guidelines. This matter can be vacated and remanded to correct that error. You can find that Mr. Morris would still need to satisfy either a clear error or a plain error standard to merit the vacation of his sentence, and that under the facts of this case, he has shown that if he had been given his properly calculated guideline range, he would have received less of a sentence than the 96 months he was sentenced to. Therefore, he's shown plain error, and under the case that I've submitted, Carrizales-Jaramillo, he has shown plain error, and the sentence should be vacated. Or alternatively, and finally, that the government's alternative method for sentencing the defendant does not apply in this case. Therefore, there is no way to correct the error short of remanding it to the district court so the district court can consider the proper enhanced sentence. That's the end of my prepared remarks, unless Your Honors have any other questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Harville. You've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Cashier.
Good morning, Your Honors. Admittedly, this is a novel approach to plain error review of application of the guidelines. With respect to the standard of review that defendant has mentioned that it could possibly be clear error, the argument that defendant or the objection that defendant raised at sentencing before the district court was with respect to the facts. He said that he did not actually produce the documents, the false identification documents himself. That was a factual argument. It did not address the legality of whether this enhancement applied. It was strictly a factual basis. So the facts should be evaluated for clear error. However, since he did not raise the legal issue, which he raises now on appeal, that should be reviewed under the plain error standard. Under the plain error standard, this court has discretion to review or to consider the issue or not to consider the issue. And the government has presented what I believe are sufficient reasons for the court not to consider this issue, and that is that a different subsection of the same guideline does clearly apply to this defendant and would entail the same two-level enhancement. So he has not suffered substantial harm to his sentence, and there is not going to be any serious miscarriage of justice as a result of not considering the issue because he has not shown that this application is not appropriate for him.
Counsel, let me ask you more generally. One of the problems with the new judge on the court, perhaps, on the sentencing guidelines. This is a group set of offenses. These three offenses were grouped for purposes of coming up with one range. Is that correct?
I believe you are correct, Judge.
And as I look at the guidelines that permits that, there are a number of things that go into it. including starting with what would be the highest offense level based on the three in our case that have been grouped together. You then look at characteristics such as the total amount of loss, and this was between $200,000 and $400,000, the total number of victims, and you're starting to add things to the offense level. But then what's in this PSR is starting to cherry pick, which sounds like a label of some derision. I don't mean it that way, but to start to pick off of individual counts that have been grouped, though, offense characteristics, which seems to me if there are three counts, you could start choosing specific offense characteristics. If they had been right on, if you had been right on the one that had been chosen, that was a two-level enhancement. If you're also right on this alternative, that actually goes to a different count. I think the one that was used went to count five. The one you want to use goes to count six.
That's correct.
You would add two more to count six, so you'd have four rather than two. My concern and what I read in the sentencing guidelines, and it's not an issue so that has been raised by either party, are you arguing that is the correct way to make this calculation? When you get out of the grouping and looking at the accumulation of amounts of loss, accumulation of victims, that you can just choose individual enhancements that go to individual counts and accumulate all of those?
Well, Your Honor, each guideline will have different provisions for how the enhancements are to be applied. In this particular case, number 10 speaks in alternatives. If the offense involved, and it lists a bunch of things, and then it says, or if it involved these things, or if it involved these things, increase by two levels. It does not indicate, it does say if the resulting offense level is less than 12, increase to level 12. It does not indicate that these are cumulative enhancements. They are, you do this, or this, or this, and you get two levels.
Well, I guess
just off the top
is,
of my head, that would be the way that one would work.
Well, I don't need to push you further on that because it's not been argued and it would have to be off the top of your head, I suppose. But that does seem to me that when you're looking at the section of the guidelines dealing with grouping, that the enhancements are also grouped enhancements. And what we're arguing over here are individual enhancements, one that goes to count five, one that goes to count six. And if you are right that it can be done that way, it seems to me that both, so long as they factually fit, could have been used. And I'm not asking you to go further and try to explain that's really the way it works or not, but that's one of the questions I have about this.
Well, I would say that in this particular case, on the facts of this case, the one that was applied does not apply. And there are two clear cases that say it does not apply. However, the other one that the government contends applies to negate parts 3 and 4 of a plain error review. The other one does clearly apply, in spite of the fact that the definition, and defendant noted this in his reply brief, the definition of means of identification in application note 9 seems to limit it. If you look further in application note 9 to paragraphs C and D, both those paragraphs further define means of identification, and they do not require that the product, the actual means of identification obtained, be that of a third person, not the defendant. They make it clear that it is the means of identification that is used that has to be that of a third person or a victim, but not the defendant or a co-conspirator.
Counsel,
but the one actual...
Let me walk through that with you. A means of identification is used twice. One, you use a means of identification to produce another means of identification. And as the terminology in here is refers to it, you breed a second means of identification. And according to the definition, a means of identification is a number or a name. It's not a driver's license or Social Security card. It's a number or a name. Do you accept? Am I reading this correctly? I mean, that's the definition. And he used his mother's number, not her name, but his
right.
mother's number. So that's the left hand, that's the starting means of identification that was used. And what he has to produce from that, what has to be bred from that, what creates the identity theft issue, is another number or name, and I'm assuming, I'm not sure it's in the record, that this driver's license that he got had a number other than her Social Security number, that it created, at least Mississippi licenses no longer use Social Security numbers. If this driver's license actually had the Social Security number, I'm not sure you have a new number. But let's just, you know, for this sort of walking through it, I'm assuming it is a different number. But it's now his number. It's got his name on it. So I'm not quite sure how to read the right-hand side of this statute. You use somebody else's name or number, and you got to create a new name or number other than of yourself.
He used his mother's Social Security number. He obtained, or I believe it was attempted to obtain, I'm not sure what, I think he did actually obtain a driver's license with his name on it, but his mother's Social Security number.
So you think the actual, I mean, maybe is there, I don't know what documentation there is, you think the Social Security number itself is how the driver's license was identified. It's the number of the license as opposed to a brand new number.
Well, the driver's license would have a different number.
Well, that's what I'm asking.
Would have a new driver's license number, which is an additional means of identification, but he used his mother's Social Security number to obtain a driver's license number in his own name.
Right. So why isn't that a means of identification? Again, my reference to left and right side may not be very clear, but I'm just saying you start in the statute with one means of identification, then you move to the other, you produced a new means of identification.
Yes.
And the definition is that has to be a name or a number. We're not looking at documents. It's a name or a number is how I interpret it.
And he got a new number, a driver's license number.
Of himself, though, because it's the one assigned now to him. So why isn't that barred by the definition that it cannot be either of a fictitious person? And I find the whole thing kind of odd, but it does seem to be the way it's written. It cannot be of a fictitious person on either side of the equation. You can't make up a Social Security number and make up a name and use it to try to create a new one because you don't have any identity theft there, I suppose, is why that's not prohibited. But if he gets a new number assigned to himself, why isn't that fall afoul of the statement that can't a means of identification is not something that has his own name on it?
Because if you read application note C, note 9C, it says a means of identification of an individual other than the defendant, that would be his mother, and the means of identification is the Social Security number, is used without that person's authorization unlawfully to produce or obtain another means of identification. And the limitation that it be not a fictitious person or not the defendant is not included in this particular more specific definition for purposes of B10CI, which is the one the government contends applies.
Well,
so
your argument,
it does not limit it there.
I think your argument it makes a lot of logical sense, except that what we're talking about is a statutory prohibition that uses a defined term, and the same defined term is used in both parts of what you start with and what you end up with. You said something very, cleverly also sounds like I'm trying to say more than I mean, but I think it's an artful argument that the means of identification that's been created doesn't have that limitation of it not being himself or a fictitious person. But that's not where the limitation appears. It appears in the definition.
That's correct. A general definition earlier in the guideline application note. And then in Part C, it is limited. And if you go to Part D, which is irrelevant for our purposes, it is redefined there also. And so it is clear to me that what the Sentencing Commission is doing is they're giving a general definition under A, and then for certain portions, subsections of the guideline, they modify that definition in an application note. And that's why it applies to this defendant, because he used a means of identification to obtain a driver's license, which is another means of identification, and it created another number with his name, but he was using his mother's Social Security number. So the government contends that it clearly applies here. Now, I do recognize that we have conceded the error in the first instance, and then also issue two, there is an error in the written judgment that will have to be corrected. So at some point, this has to be vacated and remanded to the district judge for at least correction of the judgment. However, the government contends that plain error review permits this court to affirm the defendant's actual sentence as pronounced at the sentencing hearing, because another subsection of the same guideline that was used to improperly enhance can be used to properly enhance defendant's sentence, and under that situation, his substantial rights were not affected, and the court may, in its discretion, decline to review the issue.
All right, thank you, Ms. Cassier. Mr. Harville, you've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. Your Honors, first, and I believe the most direct method of resolving this matter in the manner that this case should be resolved in, is under 3742F1. Government has conceded there's a plain error, that plain error affected the defendant's substantial rights. Therefore, this matter should be remanded. However, if you look beyond that and accept the government's second argument,
talk about concessions of the government. I think what they're it's almost they're arguing not plain error so much as there's a plain fix to what happened. Nobody considered it, but it's there, and we can plainly apply it. But I don't want to get into the metaphysics of what plain error means. But I don't think they've conceded that they're actually arguing the opposite. Your substantial rights have not been affected.
Right. That's correct. They have conceded error. And I would argue that under the facts of this case, there is plain error. And that they've cited no case, and they admit that there's no case wherein this court can say, oh, there's an alternative basis to support the judge's decision. All the cases that I've seen from this court say there's plain error. The judge sentenced the defendant to a sentence he otherwise would not have been eligible for. Therefore, it has to be remanded. What the government's trying to do is to short-circuit that and say, under what he was sentenced, we would concede that occurs. However, it's not plain error because there's a way, as you said, the plain fix. I don't think, Your Honor, you can address this point and say that we'll give the government that there can be a plain fix standard. But I think that even under the plain fix standard, you still have the problem in Application Note 9 of 2B1.1, the definition is given, and it's given for purposes of Section B10. It's not limited to certain subsections or to certain instances. Application Note Section 9A defines for purposes of B10 means of identification. As Your Honor said, it has to be someone other than the defendant. If you look to the cases, the examples it gives for when this applies, it's when a defendant obtains another individual's name or number and uses that other means of identification to obtain a bank loan in that individual's name, the other non-defendant real person's name. That's example C2I. An example C2II is a defendant obtains an individual's name and address from a source and then uses that to apply for a credit card in that individual's name. That's what this section is for. This section is meant to punish a defendant to enhance his sentence for identity theft. As Your Honor noted, that's not what occurred in this case. Breaking it down, as Your Honor did, into the left side and the right side, Mr. Morse clearly violated the left side of this equation in that he used a means of identification, that being his mother's. But he did not violate the right side. He did not come within this enhancement because he does not obtain, as is defined in the application note, a means of identification, because he merely took his driver's license and put someone else's name in there. There was no identity theft. It is odd. I agree with the government that the reading is ambiguous and could possibly in some circumstances be twisted to mean you don't need to have that right side of the equation be a means of identification, but you just cannot get past the fact that this enhancement defines generally for the entire enhancement means of identification in a manner which does not apply in this case. Therefore, as I've said, We argue that under 3742, this matter has to be remanded. But even if you accept the government's novel argument could apply in some cases, this is not the case to apply it because it does not meet the statutory or the guideline definition. Therefore, Mr. Morse would respectfully argue that his sentence should be vacated in toto, should be remanded to the district court with instructions to sentence him properly, minus the two-point enhancement, to a guideline sentence, which the court indicated in sentencing Mr. Morse within the guideline would be sufficient in this matter. Do Your Honors have any further questions?
All right. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honors.
And we noticed that you are court-appointed, and we appreciate your willingness to take the appointment. You've done a nice job on behalf of your client.
Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate it.
Your case is under submission. Last case for